Hi everyone, my name is Alex Zeltov. This is Olivia Martin. We're both from Microsoft. I'm a solutions architect concentrating on big data. And I'll let Olivia introduce herself.
And I don't have a mic, but I guess I'll speak closer to this recorded. Speak close. Him and I are on the same team. He's more focused on data engineering, and I'm more focused on deep learning and machine learning. So that's what we're going to be walking you through, a little bit of an overview of Databricks.
So, correction, it's going to be using completely all Apache Spark. It's just we're going to be utilizing our Azure Databricks environment as the workspace. It just makes it a little bit easier to get up and spin the environment up. So, actually wanted to get a list of hands. How many of you have heard of Spark before today? Excellent, pretty much everyone. Who has attended, I guess, the earlier session? I think that was like an intro to Spark. So about half. Cool. All right. So hopefully I can live up to the expectations of the previous guy. I think he was from IBM, so. yeah, we are both from Microsoft. So let's, the topic is going to be building an end-to-end application using Apache Spark. So we're going to be looking at three different sides. Actually, might be looking at three different hats. So you have an ETL engineer, so this is going to be data at rest. We're going to be looking, how do you process? And I think this will overlap to a lot of the content that maybe you've seen earlier in the day. So this is how do you actually manipulate using either Python or Scala data frames. Then we're going to introduce the streaming portion. How do you merge the data that you're reading in at rest, and also, let's say, join it to data that's coming to you from, let's say, maybe you're recording clickstream information or IoT sensor information, and you need to correlate this information and join it together. The final portion is going to be taking a look at the machine learning aspect, how to combine all of this and actually serve up as a predictive model. What we have and what we gave out to you, please raise your hand if you do not have a username and password login. So you will need this. This is essentially gives you an environment that you can log in and do this, but I'll show you how to replicate and do all of this at home as well as an offline. Anybody's missing this? Olivia? Here, actually take a look. So the first thing that I want you to do is log in, open up that link, AKMS ApacheCon, and log in with user one. Unfortunately, if I had a trial on my own personal subscription that used, and it seems it only logged down to the first five users, so doesn't matter. I've spun up enough clusters for everybody, so that's why your user ID is still going to be important. When you're going to log in, we're going to associate the user that you have as a piece of paper to that particular cluster. So the clusters are going to be named user 1 through 5, user 6 through 10, 10 through 15. And based on that, you're going to choose the cluster because we don't want to overload one single cluster. So by default, typically the way that I have, you have the user 1 associated to the first group and you cannot attach it to the different ones. Right now, I opened it up to everybody. Hopefully, we're going to have enough resources as well. Anybody, let's identify if anybody cannot log in right now. Olivia, I'll ask you. All right. Oh, fantastic. All right. This might be more of a demo than this. The problem is I tied it to my personal subscription, and I'm not sure if that was enough. We tested it earlier, and right now it seems like it's shutting down.
Link to the course materials and a good demo should work, right?
Yes.
we're staying in hotels tonight. those who are sober enough and when they go get back in to
run the demo. Oh, it doesn't work this way. You cannot be sober.
All right. We'll take a look in a second, but it seems the clusters are shutting down anyways. So take a look what's going on. While Olivia is going to take a look and try to start maybe a several clusters, we'll see. I'm going to go through the through some of the content that is a prereq. So we'll try to take a look if we can work it out. If not, this is going to be more you guys taking a look how do we actually build this. But we'll get it up and running.
I just want to point out you don't do Azure or AWS and Quadrant. It can be very expensive.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, but if you power up,
I started them at one point, all of them today.
And forget to shut it off when you pass out.
Let me see. It's also premium. Okay. All right. So let's take a look at this. All right. So let's introduce first the business problem that we're going to be trying to solve. And I'm move this over. When you log in, so if you take a look right now, if Olivia's taking a look at the clusters, but when you log in, under, if you click back all the way, there is a shared folder, ADB Workshop, if you want to take a look. So what we can do, if you can either take a look at the actual folder right now, and once we get the cluster up, I'll show you how to do the cloning. But you go to workshops, and there is introduce the business problem. That's the one that we're going to be taking a look at.
What URL do you help you?
That's the Akka link. That is correct. Try not to start all of them. Try like a couple. Oh, okay. Maybe it's running out of my course. All right, so once you log into this URL, let's do this. Let's all of us right now, I'll first get you to clone because this is not required. Open up shared folder, and there should be a folder called ADB Workshop. There is a little error right next to it. I want you to click on our error and click clone. This is going to be important because we want to clone it. Earlier, every user had their own individual workspace, but right now, because we're sharing with the user one, I'm going to clone it, and we're going to create with our name and let's say last name. So click on clone, and the only place you will be able to put it is under user one. So when you clone it, I want you to put your first name and last name so that it's going to be easier to identify so that nobody steps onto their notebooks, into each other's notebooks. At that point, you should all have, so right now, when you click on home folder, under user one, I created under, give it a second. A clone? Oh, I might have clicked canceled. All right, there we go. They're showing up. So some of you I see are cloning under the shared. But realistically, we want them to see under the users one folder. So most of you are creating it correctly.
Clearly it worked.
Some are creating ADB workshop, and it's better to put your first name and last name in the beginning so it's easier to see. But if you'll know, so whoever you are. It's taking a little bit.
So how is successfully looking at
1 through 5?
You can 1 through 5 work. I think we had I opened it as a free trial, and they locked me down to 5 users. Even though it's created, I'm not able to do it more. I've decided to save a little bit on our subscription, and that bit me in the butt because user 1 through 5 have, and they only limit me to 5 users. Yeah. So I tried the first couple.
So I would need to clone that, or I can just use the 3s?
You can still clone it. Still clone it because if we want to have our own individualized.
Yeah, we'll use the 3s.
Yep.
The only thing it copied is the lab
answer. It's going to come down. It takes a little bit of a couple of seconds. So once it's doing, because it's actually doing all of them. Why is it saying 5 nodes? Okay. So kill some of them, and if it's going to be happening, just bring up a couple. All right, so everybody has their own workspace?
No, we can't even log in.
Okay, so the new users, you should have, let me see, use user _1. Do not use the user on the piece of paper that you got. So use user 1. We had permission. Only first 5 users are allowed because I used the trial version of Databricks. And that locked me down to 5 users. Even though I synchronized and created all of them, it only allows the first 5 users. And this is what you'll see. This is free trial ends in 8 days. So it was my mistake. I shouldn't have chosen a free trial. What you get when you try a free trial.
Yeah, it seems like you'd know somebody. Get the real thing.
Why is it resizing? All right. Who else is not able to? All right, so while the rest of the folks are actually going through, let's take a look at the business problem that we're going to be trying to solve and the technology. So we're going to be using Spark to solve an end-to-end problem. So we have a fictitious electronic e-commerce store, Anytech, that we're going to be using. So we have some of the information that's going to be coming, getting recorded from a relational database system, or if it could be a CSV file. This is going to be our products information that we'll need to analyze and analyze the orders as well. So we have integration to an inventory, ERP, or CRM. In our use case, all we're going to be actually connecting is to a file system. I'll show an example how you can easily connect to a JDBC endpoint or others. We will have a streaming example that's using, and of course this jumped over here. Our streaming example, we're going to be utilizing still a file system to read in and simulate. I have an event hub as well that I can provide the keys and show you a live demo, but you can connect to Azure Event Hubs or Apache Kafka or to any other streaming system that you have a preference for. How many of you are using Apache Kafka right now? Okay, so actually quite a majority. Event Hubs is essentially very similar to Apache Kafka. It has the same kind of concepts, partitioning everything else that you're actually doing. So the lab number 4 is going to take a look at a streaming example. Part of that same lab, we're going to show you how to actually connect the streaming example and the data at rest. How do you join the two streams? So you load the data from, let's say, your database, your products, and then you want to take a look at the orders that are actually coming in from your website right away. So we're going to take a look at the orders that are coming in, let's say, into your Kafka system and merge it in real time and create live dashboards and show you a table output out of that. Store all of the results of that information back to cloud storage. We're going to use WASP as the primary storage for the data lake store, and then show a couple of examples. How do you actually connect dashboarding technologies? In our example, we can show using Power BI, but if you have Tableau or something else, how do you connect to a live cluster and connect to a GDBC endpoint to view the results of your live data that's been joined or the static data for analysis? And the last part of the lab is we're going to build a recommendation system using ALS. So part of that is you analyze the historical data, build a predictive model using ALS algorithm, and then store the prediction results into another data store. NoSQL, for instance, is a Cosmos DB that we're showing, but you can store it to whatever NoSQL, Cassandra, HBase, or other data store that you like. And in the real use case where, so for instance, you know what kind of products you want to recommend to a particular user. So what you want to do is build up a user product recommendation. So when the user logs in back to a website, it shows you, okay, for user one, you want to show products X, Y, and Z, because most likely they're going to buy this product based on previous purchase history that you've analyzed using the ALS algorithm. Azure Pass.
It's being shut down by Azure. It's being shut down by Azure.
I don't know why it's being shut down. All right, so let's take a look at the Databricks overview, the environment that we're actually using. So part of the Azure Databricks, we're going to take a look at several concepts. So what you already saw is the workspaces. Workspaces is where you store your notebooks, and you can create different library environments as well. So let me make this a little bigger so that you guys can see. So typically, you'll have, as you can see, I have users 1 through 50. But right now, for some reason, Azure is killing my free pass. And not allowing us to use the different multi-users. So what we did is essentially cloned a particular set of notebooks to a user one folder, and this is where all of your notebooks are actually residing. So when you click then on user one, this is all of your notebooks and that are available. How many of you are actually using like Jupyter Notebooks or Zeppelin for data analysis or familiar with that concept? Okay, so most of you. Good. So what is a notebook? Notebook is essentially can be a collection of markdown or actually code that you want, that you can execute as well. So when we're going to be taking a look, the following examples, let's say like reading data, this will have self-documented code and also the code that you can actually execute on a cluster. So with this, you'll be able to execute file system commands. Let me make this slightly bigger. So %fs is a magic command. For those that are coming from a Jupyter land or Zeppelin, they work very similar. So %fs says, okay, I want to execute a file command on the file system, and I'm taking a look at a particular file location right now. You'll be able to execute Spark code for reading CSV files, let's say this example, and also interacting with the Spark cluster. We We're going to take a look at some of the others. Within the Databricks, you have clusters, which is the clusters what we're having a problem right now. For some reason, Azure is killing all of our clusters. We're going to work it out. But if anything, I can actually log in using my Azure subscription that I have for work and do the demo. This is tied to my personal Hotmail, and it doesn't seem like it's liking it right now. So within the clusters, you can spin up different types of clusters. This is where you'll be able to choose the different runtimes. So this is where you can say, okay, what kind of Spark do I want to run? Do I want to run Spark 2.3, Spark 2.2? Do I want to run Spark that has machine learning libraries? Do I want to run a cluster that has GPU enabled? So within the Azure Databricks, you can run different types of workloads. So some of them can be ML-based, some of them can be ETL-based. Based on that, you'll be choosing different types of Databricks runtime. All it means is just different libraries that are actually packaged in and that are geared to run on different hardware. So within the GPU, this is where if you want to run something like Horovod, which is meant for deep learning, this is where you'll be able to select a GPU-enabled cluster. You can also choose what kind of Python version. If you've went through the previous class, Python does matter. Some of the libraries use Python 2.7. Some are going to be 3.5 or higher. So typically, I choose Python version 3. And we're going to take a look in a second what is driver type and worker type. Let me actually open this up in a second. To explain the driver type and worker types, since not everybody might be familiar. Okay. So within Spark environment, you have the notion of drivers and executors. So think of it, master and slaves. Master is the guy that's going to be scheduling the work that you actually wanted to run. Executors are your workers, so they're the ones that are going to be actually parallelizing a set of work. Within the Apache Spark, the whole idea is that you're trying to parallelize some compute, whether it's processing just simple statistics, mathematics, or you're trying to build a predictive model. You're trying to spread out and cut down on the amount of time that you're actually doing. So within the creation of a cluster, there is a definition of defining a driver type and a worker type. So a driver type is the node that's going to be storing all of the information. So when you execute, not only is he a scheduler, but he's also going to be the guy that's responsible for, that's collecting all of the work. So when you run your workloads, the data processing happens on the executors. But if you need to, let's say, visualize the results of it, you want to aggregate or bring everything back together, you bring it back to a driver. So typically, you do all the computation separately. But if you want to be able to, let's say, visualize, if you want to use like matplotlib or Bokeh or some other visualization library, you have to take the results of your computation and bring it back to the driver. So driver, why I'm showing and going through it, is the node that you'll typically need to make it a little bit beefier if you're doing any kind of visualization or trying to bring back all of those results back to a single node. So when you're choosing a driver, and of course this one too different. So when you create a driver, you might want to create your driver in the bigger amount of memory. So typically, if you're not doing any kind of visualization, you can choose same as worker, and you choose the VM type that you actually wanted to run. So, but if you're doing, let's say, aggregations and stuff that you want to bring back, make it slightly bigger. So double the amount of memory that you're actually looking for. The actual driver types and the different types of clusters that you can create, you have general purpose, memory optimized, storage optimized. Yes. So everything is Linux. Yeah.
On Azure.
Of course.
You have it on Windows?
No. Spark.
What's the Java VM? 8.9?
For this is 8.1. Behind the scenes, the Databricks actually hides all of the complexities, and you don't see what's there. You cannot, because software is a platform as a service, so you cannot SSH into the machine and do. So a lot of it is hands-off kind of. We have a different offering called Azure HD Insight that is somewhere between a PaaS and an IaaS solution where you can dial in into SSH into the machine and install packages and do everything else that you want. So So these are the driver type and worker types. So let's talk about the worker types. So worker types, you choose the type of worker that you want, storage optimized, memory optimized, compute optimized, and you also specify how many workers do I want it to have. And that's essentially going to say how many machines are you actually spinning up. So I want a minimum of 2 workers, and I can specify a maximum number of workers. Now the beauty of it is when it spins up, and I'll show it on my other subscription right now. Even if we don't get the hands-on portion, we'll just do kind of follow along for now. You can put, let's say, 100. It's going to start with the 2 nodes. Now, as you're doing and churning and calculating your results, if it needs more resources, it's going to elastically scale up and increase the number of resources that it actually needs. So it alleviates a lot of the problems. Typically, in Apache Spark cluster, if you do it, let's say, even if you download it at home on your own machine right now, you can run it easily on your laptop within a single node. So you can spin it up, or you can spin up multiple JVMs and run it on whether it's Windows, Linux, whatever flavor that you want, or Mac, you can easily run it right now. This makes it a lot easier to spin up something in a cloud. So there is Databricks on AWS, there's Databricks on Azure. So the UI is agnostic. All I'm showing is right now how to do it within the Azure environment. So if you're doing a lot of kind of experimentation and want easily to get started, this is a fantastic way to actually do it. We'll get to jobs in later, but for right now, I'm gonna actually switch to my live cluster. So I'm switching actually to mine while Olivier is trying to contact the help support desk. For some reason, they keep killing our clusters. And probably because I chose free. Do not choose free. Yes. All right, so typically, the way that it would be is you have a cluster that says, okay, I'm running. It can show you something, what kind of notebooks are actually running right now, what is actually happening. So I have right now a notebook that says Event Hub Producer that keeps sending information. This is going to be for one of the labs that I actually wanted to show. You have libraries. So one thing that I haven't covered is how do you attach libraries. So typically, you don't just spin up an Apache Spark cluster and work out of the box. A lot of times you can, but sometimes you will actually need to install other components. And I'll show you how to do it very easily. But what this tab is showing me, I have 4 libraries that are actually attached. I have scikit-learn, matplotlib, mlflow, and Event Hubs for Azure. That allows me to connect to it. And how do you actually do this? So I showed you the workspace already. So when you click home, that takes you to your user account. For all of you, this will take you to user_1. For me, it takes me to my Microsoft subscription. And this, when you click, let's say, if I'm going to go to, let's say, my workshop that I have, I can say, create library. Create library is what it allows you to attach. So you have different ways to attach. You can attach Java libraries or Scala libraries using the jar mechanism. If you have a custom jar that you already have, that will be used. You have PyPy packages. So this is, if you're a Python developer, this will be the mechanism that you actually install. Make sure that it registers part of the PyPy registry. And Maven coordinates. So for instance, the one that we're I'm going to be showing using the event hubs or Apache Kafka. This is where you'll put in the Maven coordinates. So your Maven coordinates, I'm assuming everybody's here familiar with Maven. Okay, good. So you put in the Kafka version or the event hub version, and this will go in and install it automatically for you. So when you actually come back to your clusters, you can easily see what are the libraries that are actually installed and loaded. The beauty of it, not only does it, since Spark is distributed, you have to install it across all of your nodes. This will go out and push the libraries to everything. So when you say, okay, I want to learn stuff, install scikit-learn, it will go in every single node and install it. Typically, if you're running vanilla Apache Spark, you have to go in, SSH, or create a script, either manually SSH into it, or you create a script, and that installs it. Not a problem, but it's one of those kind of nice little things. So this is a simple scenario. Let me show you how to create a notebook. Since this is, you're already seeing a bunch of notebooks, but let's say I'm going to create a notebook called Apache Con. And I apologize, this should have been follow along, but this is right now, you guys watch. So what I did, and I did it too quickly, let me do it one more time. Create notebook. You give it a name, and then you give a language. So Spark supports different languages right now. It supports, actually Java is missing from there. You can do PySpark, that's Python, Scala, using SQL interface, and you can actually interchange. So when you create a particular notebook, you can still mix and match between the two, and I'll show that as part of our examples. And you can use R. So there's Spark R implementation for distributed compute as well. So what I just did is I created a Python script, gave it a name, and then you can attach it to a particular cluster. So I have a cluster up and running right now called Cluster 1. Once it opens up, for the sanity check, I would have done 1 plus 1. It's going to wait to run. And notice, the first time when it actually runs, it's going to be fairly slow. I'm assuming my cluster didn't die. Nope. So I should go back.
So technically, the notebook runs on your driver node, right?
Yes. Well, no. So the notebook is actually on something called the Databricks control plane. So it's separate, and then it actually communicates to, they have like a Spark submit kind of equivalent. So HDNSI has Spark Magic and Libby. This is proprietary, what they're actually using behind the scenes.
Are you still paying for that additional resource or that kind of thing? Like, what are you paying for from a platform perspective?
So, what is happening?
Is the answer why?
No, it says cancel. Somebody. This is. Do I still work at Microsoft? We might have to switch to Olivier's right now. I'm not sure. I might not be working there. Interesting. No, I didn't hit it by mistake. There's something happening very. We might get, can you ping Eric? See if we can get his, or do you have yours up and running?
I have one that's running.
Do you have yours?
Mine can be running.
We might switch to my friends.
I don't know how to access it.
I'll create a new cluster for right now.
I have one cluster here.
Is it up and running?
It's not up. It's going to be up by the time.
Okay. All right, so let me go back for it for a second.
I'll give you permission to it.
I might switch to yours. Do you have my notebooks there?
The notebooks are there.
Okay, that's fine.
I may have changed one of the things. That's because they weren't working.
That's fine. That's fine. All right. It's All right. So what I did, I opened up lab number two, mounting storage. And I'll go over it in a second. And hopefully my other cluster is going to come back up. And I'll show it in a second. Within Azure or AWS, so you have an AWS S3, and Azure you have WASP equivalent or ADLS, you can connect using Spark to a remote blob store. Databricks has a simplification process for how do you connect and mount. So what you can do is essentially mount a remote cloud storage, whether it's going to be WASP, which is Azure's, or S3. And you can designate a mount point that you can actually log in. So once you run this step, this says, OK, illegal argument exception, it's already mounted. That's because I already ran it once. But what I'm doing is I'm specifying the source. Where am I actually going to? So I'm saying I'm going to my ADB workshop account. And this is the container that I'm actually looking. And I'm mounting to a mount training source. Once I did it, this is available to everybody. So if we get our clusters ever running, this mount point is going to be available to everybody in this subscription. So typically, if you actually run this, this is, let's say, we're assuming we're on the same department. You can have a workspace per department. So you have IT, you have finance. And the administrator goes out and sets it up. So he mounts the mount points that you actually want to have access to the data. So this, we mount it to a particular location, specifying some of the configuration keys. So this is actually just a SAS token saying, this is my information, and I have access to mount training sources. Once you do this, you have ability to run the magic commands that I was referring to earlier. So %fs, I'm saying, I want to switch to a file system. Even though this notebook right now, it says it's running Python, I can switch using the magic commands to run different types of commands. So I can run file system, I can run SQL, I can run Scala, I can run R. So this gives you the ability to switch and run between different languages.
Does WS ABS use a similar paradigm as buckets and folders?
Exactly. So you have a container.
So when you're mounting the
folder? I'm mapping to a container, which is essentially a bucket. So if you can map to a bucket, and within the bucket, then you have access to everything. And there is also an equivalent of a Scala. But what it does, once you do it, you have access to this training sources. Let me take a look if this is up and running. I can try running it right now. Let me see if I can detach. And this one is still up and running. Waiting to run. Definitely having some sort of permissions today. Is yours up and running?
Not yet.
Okay.
It should be up soon. I think they're okay.
All right. So while this is going, I'll keep going so that we don't lose time. So let me open up the notebook, the same one that you guys have, since I can't seem to run it either. So lab three, that's the one that we're actually going to be looking through. So we're going to be concentrating on this section. This is where we're simulating right now data that came in already, let's say from an ERP system or from a relational database, and we exported and stored that information into WASP. So what I'm going to be showing is essentially a file that's been loaded. But you could also connect directly to, let's say, either on-prem or to your relational database that's already in the cloud. There's ways to do both. So let's take a look at the example. This is going to be reading and writing data using Parquet and CSV. So the first example is, so in the typical ETL pipeline, you have your raw data that's being landed, whether you got it from a vendor or from your relational database system. We have a file called products.csv, and I'm going to switch to my other notebook because this doesn't have the outputs so that you can see it.
Mine's ready.
Does it run? Okay. We're going to do a quick switch to his environment.
Let me log you there, or you want to use this one?
Oh, yeah.
Let me log you right here. I'll do this.
Hold on. Give us, guys, 2 minutes if you want to take a water break or bio break, and we're going to log out. So open up. Okay.
I just ran that command there.
Cool. All right. Thank you. Apologize for the slight delay. So what I did is just switch to Olivier's cluster instead of mine. So this is actually executing the magic command file system. Let's take a look at the head of the file. So remember, mount training sources, this is where we load it in. So what I can do is let's execute the same command just so that you see a little bit more about this. And he can actually, you can add new cells easily using the plus sign. So you can execute the ls commands, drill down, and we're going to be looking at different files that we actually have within the file system that's mapped by the remote storage. So this is a product CSV, an extract from a SQL database, essentially, that has the products categories. So let's take a look at how do you actually interact with this. How do you interact with Spark? So some of the examples are going to be using PySpark, some are going to be using SQL. So what we're doing first is we're saying, okay, we're defining where the file is. So this is mount training sources. This is our mount point, initac product CSV. I'm not specifying a particular file in this instance. What I'm saying is look at the full directory. So within the product CSV, I could have lots of different CSVs. You don't have to define this. This is, can be actually, it will read in recursively. Within Spark, the main entry port is going to be always spark dot whatever that you're actually trying to do. spark.read, spark.write, spark.readstream, writestream. There's going to be different mechanisms, but everything starts within essentially Spark. So you were saying, okay, I want to open up a reader, and then you're going to specify options. That's typically the same notation. You have options, and in this instance right now, they're saying, if you want to have a different delimiter instead of a comma separated, you can specify something else. Then I'm saying, okay, I want to read a CSV file. This is pointing to this location. It's as simple as that. Once you point to it, what it's going to do, it's actually going to it builds a plan. It doesn't execute anything. So if you went to the class earlier, Spark is lazy. It does not do anything until you execute an action. What we're doing right now is just right now we're not even doing transformation. Right now all we're doing is building a plan. So when you execute it, it took pretty fast. When I'm doing a display on this information, I'm actually saying, okay, I want to grab the information and actually run it. Now, what's wrong with this? I'm said, okay, I loaded the CSV. What's wrong with the example that we're seeing right now? Exactly. So product ID, category, brand, all this is now part of a row. So our columns are defined as C0, C1. That doesn't make a lot of sense, right? The other thing is, if I do this, if I execute this and show you expand this, it says temp data frame is just strings right now as well. So nothing, I mean, you can do some things with it, but that's not what you really want to do with integers or long types. So what we're going to do is we're going to define two more options. And can you guys see in the back, or should I make it a little bigger? You're good? Okay. Same thing, spark.read, then we pass two more options. Headers equals to true, and first schema equals to true. So this will automatically say, read the first line and treat it as the header, and then infer schema, look through the whole file and infer the types. Do you think this is a good idea or a bad idea?
Bad idea.
Bad idea, that's right. Why is it a bad idea? Be more specific.
I mean, you have to go through the whole file to figure out the types of everything.
That's right.
Yeah, and then you have to go back and change the types.
Exactly. So remember, Spark is meant to deal with big data sizes. So typically, if your file is less than a gig or even gigs, you can do it on a single machine using just Python R or whatever Java, whatever your language is that is friendly to analytics. Run it on a single one. This is when you're getting into hundreds of gigabytes, terabytes. This is where it makes sense. It makes a lot more sense, especially if you need to scale out the performance and get it much faster. So if you get it in tens of gigabytes, makes sense. Anything less than a gig, rethink your solution. Whoever's doing on a gigabyte size file, that they're just trying to beef up their resume, essentially. Nothing wrong with that. I did not say that. So absolutely right. We're all here to get paid. Severity one. All right, so going back to infer schema, you have to read the whole file really bad. So if you have a 100 gigabyte file, that will take 10, 15, 20, 30 minutes to actually scan in that whole file, even though it will be reading it distributed, but it's actually going to take quite a while. And every single time you have to do it, that's something that you're going to pay a penalty. So the better way is to specify a schema. And we'll show an example how to do that later on as well. All right, so let's rerun this. Notice, now when I have the data frame, it took pretty fast, and now I have my product ID as integer, strings, I have price as double, and I can now display the data frame. If you take a look now, the product ID, category, brand are now columns. So now everything is being displayed and viewed correctly. I'm going to delete my friend's cell. He was testing out some stuff. You can also do it using SQL. Remember, right now I showed you a PySpark example. You can do it also using Scala or R. How many of you know of SQL here? So I should ask how many of you don't know SQL. That would be probably the more proper question. But nobody's going to raise their hand, even if they don't know it. So the nice thing with Spark is you can do a lot of the operations just using Spark SQL. So there's several projects. And do we have a notebook? No notebook, no nothing. So within the Apache Spark, there's several components that are being defined. There's the Apache Spark core. There's Apache Spark SQL. There's Apache Streaming. There's graphing technology. And there's Apache Spark ML and Apache Spark ML Lib, which is essentially being deprecated. It's based on the RDD technology. You guys covered RDDs and data frames today? Okay. So I'm not dropping down to that level. RDD is essentially the initial version. That's the low-level API. And data frames is an abstraction. And I'm going to talk about data frames and more. But think data frames, all it is just a SQL table. So if you know what a SQL table, that's what a data frame is. It comes from the pandas and from Python pandas and R's data frames. They're the same kind of concept. So everything that I showed you right now using PySpark, you can do easily using SQL notation. So you have run percent %SQL. What I'm doing is, remember, percent, that's switching to a magic command, like percent %FS. Now this is percent %SQL. I'm switching to a magic command, and I'm defining a table. Within this, I'm saying, OK, drop table within the default database, and I'm creating a new table within the same options that I'm doing. So this create table is a regular SQL. I'm specifying using CSV. If you're going to be using, let's say, JSON or XML, you say using JSON or using XML, it will know how to interpret it as well. Your options will be exactly the same. They're just key value. So you specify the path, the header, and first schema equals to true. And then you can execute a select statement on this. So what it's actually doing behind the scenes, it's actually creating, let me run this. It dropped the table and created a new table called KP products. This data is actually going to be part of this object that I haven't shown earlier yet. So we took a look at workspaces, we took a look at clusters, we haven't looked at the jobs yet. So within the data, this is the table that got created. So to make it more interactive, let's say I'll just call it Apache. And this is going to be live. Once this finishes running.
It's there.
Oh, yeah. Cool. So this will load and create a table. So you can see the schema that's being actually created. You have the sample data that's actually loaded as well.
That works only you have one file in that directory.
No, you can have hundreds of files, thousands of files.
And then what do you put in the create table?
So if you notice, it puts in the directory, not the files.
I know, but when you create table and then you put a name on the table, what then happens to the multiple files? They all have to comply with the same name.
They have to be the same schema. So essentially, the schema has to be
JSON merging and arcane merging will happen with those two formats, but with CSV, they have to be the same.
Yes, correct.
Or the same number of columns.
Columns, yes. And they have to be, at runtime, it's going to blow up if you specify the number of columns is the same. So technically, the types are not going to get checked until later on. So you've, in the previous class, you learned RDDs, data frames, data sets. You guys talked about data sets. data sets are essentially strongly typed. So everything that we're dealing right now underneath, including, let's say, SQL and what I'm showing, what was showing earlier here, when we created, we did a spark.read, this returns a data frame. There is a way to create a strongly typed, and that's when you're actually specifying. I want to infer, and at compile time, it will check and throw some of theirs. There is performance issues right now with the data sets, so there's trade-offs. Be careful which one you're actually using. So 90% of the time, I say use data frames right now. The 10% that you'll be looking at data sets. But this data frame and this SQL, when you create it, when it's going to interact with this table, it's going to use data frames. There's actually a good image that shows a comparison of data frame and languages. Data frame versus RDD on Python. I should have thrown this in. So this shows Python Scala, but I think this one is going to be different. Okay.
So speaking of laziness of Spark, since you've created the table, it means that basically the file is already all files we loaded and distributed across the multiple clusters.
They're the files are on a WASP. They're going to get read in when you execute an action. So far, everything when you do, let's say, data frame dot show. Or using a magic command called display from the Databricks, which behind the scenes does just the data frame.show with n number of rows that you want to display. That's when it actually will go out and load this data into memory. What?
The display, it was in the notebook.
Display was there, so this is when action is taken. So display is the same thing as data frame.show. So for what you guys were, this is the vanilla Spark. So I apologize. Sometimes my brain's jumping too ahead, assuming that you guys know what it is. Display, all it is just a shorthand notation to show an HTML widget. So display is just an HTML widget that properly formats. Behind the scenes, all it does, it takes this Spark data frame, converts it to a Python panda, and then visualizes that Python panda as an HTML. So that's what happens in Jupyter. If you're using, let's say, HD Insight and you use Spark Magic in Jupyter, everything gets loaded back to a driver node as a pandas data frame, and then you can manipulate and show it in a nice, pretty format.
How do you know what the HD is of a certain file? Like, let's say you have thousands of files in the direct and you're processing them over 16 cores.
Mm-hmm. ETA, or
when
the file gets processed, how would we know how? So the driver will, behind the scenes, all of that spreading of calculations, everything is handled by the driver. So the worker nodes will communicate to it. You can see when it's actually, and I'll show you, there is a Spark UI, and it shows you a list of tasks that actually breaks down, and it shows you where it's actually processing. Plus, it can show you on each node. For instance, a lot of times what happens is data skew is an issue. So let's say one file could be huge. Let's say 1 gigabyte. And the rest of the files, I don't know, 20 megabytes. So the 20 megabytes get all distributed. And then this 1 gigabyte gets sent to a single executor. So this is where data skew shows up. So when you look at your Spark UI, this is the major issue that most customers actually see, is that you have to take a look. This one particular node took a while. A, it could mean either the data size difference, or B, there's something wrong with that worker node. Or C, my cluster's completely screwed up, and like it's happening today, and you have to ask Olivier to jump on his cluster really quickly. So within here, how many of you are familiar with Apache Hadoop projects and are actually using it? Okay, Hive Metastore, rings a bell? Cool. So behind the scenes, the Apache Spark, when you're creating, and this is in the percent SQL, you can do the same thing in the Scala PySpark, it actually uses a Hive Metastore behind the scenes. The Databricks has it built in, and it's abstracted. It uses Hive 1.21 Hive Metastore, not the Hive 2.0. So just be wary of the Apache Hive project and Apache Spark, they're forking and they're maintaining differently. Apache Hive is now 2.0 and it's going to go to 3.0. The community is going slightly differently. But what it's doing, it's when you're seeing this data, this is actually your Hive master that I'm taking. I'm displaying. So Olivia only has one single default database. I have a bunch of different ones. And you show the tables that are registered there. You, if you have, let's say, a Hadoop cluster, you could actually share it. So within like HD Insight that has a Hive Metastore, you can query it using Apache Hive, and you can query it using Apache Spark from both. So it allows you to query from two different systems. All it is, what Apache Hive is storing, it's just the metadata information. What are the column names, and where is it actually stored? So here, it's just a sample, but I'll show you in a second how to view this slightly better. So if I go back to mine, and let's say, let's introduce a new cell, %SQL. And I'm going to say KP products. And why is that now? Maybe this is actually cutting it off. I'm not sure why. I'll pull it up, but there is a way that actually shows you the full path. You can actually log into that either Hive or using Beeline and actually see the full URL. Where's the storage stored behind the scenes? Show create table. You can show databases and do all of this. So if you do, this is not going to show you the actual path. So you can say show tables. And this is going to show you the tables that you're seeing within the data cluster. So this is the same thing within the actual data tab. Wasn't sure who was saying, so okay. All right. So let's talk about something quick review. So you have transformation and actions. Transformation is when you're doing something within a data frame. So that's like your select statements, distinct, group by, sum, order by. And this applies the same way to the data frame within SQL or PySpark or Scala. Actions is when you're actually doing something. So I'm saying, okay, give me a show or count or collect or save. Those are the only actions that you're actually interacting with here. So driving a little bit further, how do I do this now the proper way? I want to read in the data from the CSV with the user-defined schema. So now, same definitions. I have product ID. I'm defining as long type, string type, brand as string type. What we're doing is we're creating a struct type that defines the column name and the data type for it. So this gets stored as a CSV schema object that we're going to apply when we're actually going to be reading this information. So the only thing that changes now is we're saying spark.read, options header still equal to true, and instead of infer schema, we're saying, okay, here's the CSV schema that we're actually using. So at this point, now I have a product's data frame. Let me run this. That will have everything. Notice, before it took almost five or six seconds. Now it took 0.2 seconds. Much, much faster. At this point, when I do the display, this will do exactly the same as you saw before. Now, what do you think? Can you do this using SQL? Exactly.
This table and this cluster is visible for all the notebooks or just for this one?
So are the clusters available for everybody?
When I create the table, it's possible to access this table from other notebook?
Yes. So there is two. What are we going to be showing us? Remember, you have a data frame that we use PySpark, right, to access. So we had a products data frame, and you can register it as a temporary view. So in this instance, called products. At that point, you can view it using SQL statement. Now, this is only going to be stored while this cluster is up and running. When you execute it using the SQL, you create an external table. So that's stored in the Hive Metastore. So even if you shut down your clusters, your notebooks are shut down, that is permanently stored. So I shut it down, I bring back, I come back again tomorrow. I can then still go do %SQL select star from products table. That definition is stored within the Hive Metastore. So that's why you have a Hive Metastore. So you can actually store and make it an external table. So there's a concept of managed, just like in Hive, there's managed tables and external tables, but here you're saying, okay, I want it to be permanently stored. And that's going to be registered within the Hive Metastore.
Is it possible to share this Metastore with the AGA site, for example?
Yes. Yeah. So when you're creating Azure Databricks, you can actually create a cluster and has an entry to point to the actual SQL Hive Metastore. So you specify the host name, the path, and the password, and it will connect to it. So I have an example that actually I've done it.
Nice.
Yeah. So you can exchange and use it between the two.
Is that kind of bootstrapping? Sorry.
No.
This nice dev tool, web-based dev tool, is called Notebook.
They're notebooks. So they're like Jupyter Zeppelin. There's Scala Notebook. There's different versions. Yes, for some of them. It's better for Scala. Python is not as good. So they're all, IDE is still going to be your friend if you're like a true, let's say. But it's good for a lot of interactive kind of
experimentation.
Experimentation, exactly. Yeah. Plus, I like this a lot better than showing everything in PowerPoint.
Oh, yeah. Or in Visual Studio.
So the table is created, but we are still reading the data from
Yes.
It's not clone. So what happens if in between I add a few more CSV files to the same directory?
Yes.
Or something gets deleted?
So you have to run something called refresh table. So there is typically how you do it. So everything right now is just flat. In the realistic scenario, you would still partition the data. So you would partition the data, let's say, by date. If you add new folders, you have to refresh, and there is also a repair table, essentially. There is periodic commands, like SQL commands, that you have to run to optimize so that it picks up the new folder structure and new files. Otherwise, it doesn't. There is something that Databricks has, which is not open source. I'm just briefly going to say it, but it's called Delta as the file format. It actually optimizes and looks for all of this automatically for you, but it's not part of the Apache Spark. Yes, correct. And then you have to periodically refresh. Very similar to how Hive is doing it. Hive has the same refresh table that actually that same command is running.
Not necessarily true. If you run multiple commands across the data frame, each time you do a complete DAG.
No, he was saying a drop in a brand new file, not within the data frame. So if you modify within data frame, it will know.
Within the execution.
Mm-hmm.
Python. If you do multiple actions over the same basic data frame, so read in this data frame, do this, write out something, do this, write out something else, between each one of those, any one that creates a full graph of its own activities will define an individual job. And if you change the underlying data between those two separate jobs,
mm-hmm.
there is a chance that it will pick up. It will reread the data again from disk, wherever it's being stored. So
quite possible.
You get different calculations between two jobs if you haven't done something to correct yourself.
My recommendation, as an ETL developer, run a refresh table command. That's gonna make your life a lot easier.
Or cache all your data once and make sure you're doing it on the exact same data at the same time.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
But you have multiple columns, let's say right now you have 10 columns, but if you have a CSV file that is, you know, 60 to 70 columns, I have to, like, how would I define the CSV schema? Then I have to go through each and every time to know it beforehand?
So, two ways. There is the manual way that you can do it. You can define the columns as I showed you. What you can do is you can infer the schema once, save that schema as an object, as a JSON object, store it to a file system, and then from now on, always read it. So if it's not, I don't know, 100 gigs, you can easily infer. Once you inferred it, save it to disk, and then read it back out as a JSON object. At that point, it becomes your schema. Anything that I say more than 20 columns is probably worthwhile doing. I'm lazy. So I'm going to do, if I have hundreds of columns, or sometimes I've seen customers thousands of columns, whole separate discussion, if you have anything more than 5,000 columns, it blows up. Tried it so many times, there's still a bug in Apache, I can point to a gyro. But anything that's more than 20 columns, yeah, run it, infer schema, save it as a JSON object, and load it back out. So that was the example using, I didn't finish. So we had a data frame, right, that I read in, was pretty quick, 2.2 seconds. Now I can take a data frame and now convert it into SQL. Remember, Databricks easily can talk PySpark, Scala, or SQL. I can go from a data frame now to SQL. So what I can do is I can register something as a temporary view. And this is a fantastic way if you have, let's say, you're an ETL developer using Python or Scala, and then you have your R developer. You can interchange everything that's coming in between the two users using this functionality by registering as a data frame, and then other languages can see it. So now it becomes just a temporary table. At that point, you can use anything else that you want. So now, once I have this products, and I'll call this right now, products Alex Apache, so that it's very unique. Click percent SQL. And so, sorry, Olivia, I'm messing up your notebooks.
Probably fixing them.
That I not created. At this point, now within SQL, I have access to the same. So pretty slick. Now, how do you do this the same thing using SQL? Notice, this is a straight out DDL. The only thing you have to make sure is that the columns are in order. As long as your columns are in order, that's it. It works the same way. So if you know SQL DDL statements, everything's hunky-dory. The only thing you're passing in is now is path and header and no infer schema. Now, when I execute this, I'm dropping a table. Voila, I have my same table. Now, what if I want to go from SQL back to Python or to Scala? I can do the same thing. I can say table, the name of the table that's registered in the Hive Metastore, and store it into the data frame. Now, I have data frame from SQL, and everything is now back. So now I have a new object that's defined. Remember, we're still on the ETL pipeline. Now, you have part of your ETL. You have raw data that landed from your vendor, your ERP system. We've read it in. Typically, whenever you do anything else, you're going to store it as a Parquet format, either Parquet or ERC. Those are the columnar types that you want to interact with. And I'm assuming you guys went through earlier the Parquet a little bit. Okay. So next phase in the ETL pipeline, writing out to Parquet. And what we're doing is you take the data frame, products.dataframe, .write, mode that you want to do it. You either overwrite or append, and then specify the file format that you want. So here I'm saying Parquet. It could be ORC, it could be JSON, it could be ever, whatever you want, and the location. And this is backed by the WASP, so it's writing out back to the cloud storage right now. Now, when I actually write this out, so it wrote out to products RK. I'm going to call this products Apache so that it's unique. Let's take a look at products Apache. Voila. You have your CSV stored in a Snappy Parquet format. Snappy is the default compression. And that's typically the recommended. There is different performances between the compression and the read and write. So we'll take this. Here's an example how to do the same thing using SQL. So it is a create table using as a select. So just like you're used to in SQL world, you can do select star and insert it into this new brand new table. So I'm saying create table KP products parquet using parquet as the file format, the path where I want it to write out. In this instance, I'm going to say, let's say, dot SQL, and it's going to do exactly the same operation. At this point, I will have a products.sql. Voila, same files, almost identical.
Is the file format like pluggable? Can you create a new one?
What do you mean? Like you wanted your own file type? Please tell me why. The beauty of the Apache project, usually most of them are going to be covered.
Okay.
So. Yep. All right, so that's lab three, and this is a natural stop for until we do the next one, lab number four. So how about we do a quick 5-minute break?